Chapter 16. 12 days, sir, he said, and it's just a fortnight since we left the anchorage. His equable voice sounded mournful somehow. He waited a bit, then added, colon, it's the first time that it looks as if we were to have some rain. I noticed then the broad shadow on the horizon, extinguishing the low stars completely, while those overhead, when I looked up, seemed to shine down on us through a veil of smoke. How it got there, how it had crept up so high, I couldn't say. It had an ominous appearance. The air did not stir. At a renewed invitation from Ransom, I did go down into the cabin, to, in his own words, try and eat something. I don't know that the trial was very successful. I suppose at that period I did exist on food in the usual way, but the memory is now that in those days life was sustained on invincible anguish, as a sort of infernal stimulant, exciting and consuming at the same time. It's the only period of my life in which I attempted to keep a diary. No, not the only one. Years later, in conditions of moral isolation, I did put down on paper the thoughts and events of a score of days. But this was the first time. I don't remember how it came about, or how the pocketbook and the pencil came into my hands. It's inconceivable that I should have looked for them on purpose. I suppose they saved me from the crazy trick of talking to myself. Strangely enough, in both cases I took to that sort of thing in circumstances in which I did not expect, in colloquial phrase, to come out of it. Neither could I expect the record to outlast me. This shows that it was purely a personal need for intimate relief, and not a call of egotism. Here I must give another sample of it, a few detached lines, now looking very ghostly to my own eyes, out of the part scribbled that very evening. There is something going on in the sky like a decomposition, like a corruption of the air, which remains as still as ever. After all, mere clouds, which may or may not hold wind or rain. Strange that it should trouble me so. I feel as if all my sins had found me out. But I suppose the trouble is that the ship is still lying motionless, not under command, and that I have nothing to do to keep my imagination from running wild amongst the disastrous images of the worst that may befall us. What's going to happen? Probably nothing. Or anything. It may be a furious squall coming, but end foremost. And on deck there are 5 men with the vitality and the strength of, say, 2. We may have all our sails blown away. Every stitch of canvas has been on her since we broke ground at the mouth of the Mianam 15 days ago. Or 15 centuries. It seems to me that all my life before that momentous day is infinitely remote, a fading memory of light-hearted youth, something on the other side of a shadow. Yes, sails may very well be blown away. And that would be like a death sentence on the men. We haven't strength enough on board to bend another suit. Incredible thought, but it is true. Or we may even get dismasted. Ships have been dismasted in squalls simply because they weren't handled quick enough, and we have no power to whirl the yards around. It's like being bound hand and foot preparatory to having one's throat cut. And what apples me most of all is that I shrink from going on deck to face it. It's due to the ship, it's due to the men who are there on deck, some of them, ready to put out the last remnant of their strength at a word from me. And I am shrinking from it. From the mere vision. My first command. Now I understand that strange sense of insecurity in my past. I always suspected that I might be no good. And here is proof positive. I am shirking it. I am no good. At that moment, or, perhaps, the moment after, I became aware of Ransom standing in the cabin. Something in his expression startled me. It had a meaning which I could not make out. I exclaimed, "Somebody's dead." It was his turn then to look startled. "Dead? Not that I know of, sir. I have been in the forecastle only 10 minutes ago, and there was no dead man there then." "You did give me a scare," I said. His voice was extremely pleasant to listen to. He explained that he had come down below to close Mr. Burns' port in case it should come on to rain. He did not know that I was in the cabin, he added. How does it look outside? I asked him. Very black, indeed, sir. There is something in it for certain. In what quarter? All round, sir. I repeated idly, colon all round. For certain, with my elbows on the table. Ransom lingered in the cabin, as if he had something to do there, but hesitated about doing it. I said suddenly, you think I ought to be on deck? He answered at once, but without any particular emphasis or accent, colon I do, sir. I got to my feet briskly, and he made way for me to go out. As I passed through the lobby I heard Mr. Burns' voice saying, shut the door of my room, will you, steward? And Ransom's rather surprised colon certainly, sir. I thought that all my feelings had been dulled into complete indifference. But I found it as trying as ever to be on deck. The impenetrable blackness beset the ship so close, that it seemed that, by thrusting one's hand over the side one could touch some unearthly substance. There was in it an effect of inconceivable terror, and of inexpressible mystery. The few stars overhead shed a dim light upon the ship alone, with no gleams of any kind upon the water, in detached shafts piercing an atmosphere which had turned to soot. It was something I had never seen before, giving no hint of the direction from which any change would come, the closing in of a menace from all sides. There was still no man at the helm. The immobility of all things was perfect. If the air had turned black, the sea, for all I knew, might have turned solid. It was no good looking in any direction, watching for any sign, speculating upon the nearness of the moment. When the time came, the blackness would overwhelm silently the bit of starlight falling upon the ship, and the end of all things would come without a sigh, stir, or murmur of any kind, and all our hearts would cease to beat like run-down clocks. It was impossible to shake off that sense of finality. The quietness that came over me was like a foretaste of annihilation. It gave me a sort of comfort, as though my soul had become suddenly reconciled to an eternity of blind stillness. The seaman's instinct alone survived whole in my moral dissolution. I descended the ladder to the quarter deck. The starlight seemed to die out before reaching that spot, but when I asked quietly, colon, are you there, man? My eyes made out shadow forms starting up around me, very few, very indistinct. And a voice spoke, colon, all here, sir. Another amended anxiously. All that are any good for anything, sir. Both voices were very quiet and unringing, without any special character of readiness or discouragement. Very matter-of-fact voices. We must try to haul this mainsail close up, I said. The shadows swayed away from me without a word. Those men were the ghosts of themselves, and their weight on a rope could be no more than the weight of a bunch of ghosts. Indeed, if ever a sail was hauled up by sheer spiritual strength, it must have been that sail, for, properly speaking, there was not muscle enough for the task in the whole ship, let alone the miserable lot of us on deck. Of course, I took the lead in the work myself. They wandered feebly after me from rope to rope, stumbling and panting. They toiled like titans. We were half an hour at it at least, and all the time the black universe made no sound. When the last leech line was made fast, my eyes, accustomed to the darkness, made out the shapes of exhausted men drooping over the rails, collapsed on hatches. One hung over the after capstan, sobbing for breath, and I stood amongst them like a tower of strength, impervious to disease, and feeling only the sickness of my soul. I waited for some time fighting against the weight of my sins, against my sense of unworthiness, and then I said, now, men, we'll go aft and square the main yard. That's about all we can do for the ship, and for the rest she must take her chance. Why, as we all went up it occurred to me that there ought to be a man at the helm. I raised my voice not much above a whisper, and, Noiselessly, an uncomplaining spirit in a fever-wasted body appeared in the light aft, the head with hollow eyes illuminated against the blackness which had swallowed up our world and the universe. The bared forearm extended over the upper spoke seemed to shine with a light of its own. I murmured to that luminous appearance, "Keep the helm right amidships." It answered in a tone of patient suffering, "Right amidships, sir." Then I descended to the quarter deck. It was impossible to tell whence the blow would come. To look round the ship was to look into a bottomless, black pit. The eye lost itself in inconceivable depths. I wanted to ascertain whether the ropes had been picked up off the deck. One could only do that by feeling with one's feet. In my cautious progress, I came against a man in whom I recognized Ransom. He possessed an unimpaired physical solidity which was manifest to me at the contact. He was leaning against the quarter-deck capstan and kept silent. It was like a revelation. He was the collapsed figure sobbing for breath I had noticed before we went on the poop. "You have been helping with the mainsail," I exclaimed in a low tone. "Yes, sir," sounded his quiet voice. "Man, what were you thinking of? You mustn't do that sort of thing." After a pause he assented, "I suppose I mustn't." Then after another short silence he added, "I am all right now, quickly," between the telltale gasps. I could neither hear nor see anybody else, but when I spoke up, answering sad murmurs filled the quarter deck, and its shadow seemed to shift here and there. I ordered all the halyards laid down on deck clear for running. "I'll see to that, sir," volunteered Ransom in his natural, pleasant tone, which comforted one, and aroused one's compassion to, somehow. That man ought to have been in his bed, resting, and my plain duty was to send him there. But perhaps he would not have obeyed me. I had not the strength of mind to try. All I said was, "Go about it quietly, Ransom." Returning on the poop I approached Gambrel. His face, set with hollow shadows in the light, looked awful, finally silenced. I asked him how he felt, but hardly expected an answer. Therefore, I was astonished at his comparative loquacity. "Them shakes leaves me as weak as a kitten, sir," he said, preserving finally that air of unconsciousness, as to anything but his business a helmsman should never lose. "And before I can pick up my strength, that there outfit comes along and..." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.